I thank the honourable members for their comments. I will first address Mr. Derek Goh's question about the recent Court of Appeal judgment on the constitutional challenge to Section 377A of the Penal Code. AGC is looking at the judgment carefully. The government has explained its stand. Prime Minister Lee said in Parliament in 2007, when the Penal Code was amended but Section 377A was left unchanged, that we want to be, and I quote, a stable society with traditional heterosexual family values, but with space for homosexuals to live their lives and to contribute to society. He added, and I quote, among them are some of our friends, our relatives, our colleagues, our brothers and sisters, or some of our children, our kith and kin. This remains our stand today. These are deeply divisive issues. That is why we take a live and let live approach. We seek to be an inclusive society where mutual respect and tolerance for different views and practices are paramount. Government has thus taken the approach that while Section 377A remains on the books, there will be no proactive enforcement, and AGC takes a similar approach. We expressly included in the MRHA, Maintenance of Religious Harmony Act, that any attack on LGBT plus groups or on persons because they are LGBT plus will be an offence and will not be tolerated. LGBT plus individuals are entitled to live peacefully without being attacked or threatened. Likewise, any attack on any other group based on their religion or religious beliefs, even if those beliefs run counter to values held by LGBT plus groups, will not be acceptable. So our emphasis on gradual evolution and on traditional families remain constant. However, since this issue was last discussed in Parliament in 2007, social attitudes towards homosexuality have gradually shifted. One of the things that upsets the LGBT plus community is that many feel that their experience of being hurt or rejected by their families, friends, schools, and companies is not recognized, indeed often denied. At the same time, a large majority want to preserve the overall tone of our society, in particular the traditional view of marriage as being between a man and a woman, and that children should be raised within such a family structure. Their concern is not Section 377A per se, but the broader issues of marriage and family. Many amongst this group also support decriminalizing homosexual sex between men. Both these viewpoints are valid and important. Policies need to evolve to keep abreast of such changes in views. And legislation needs to evolve to support updated policies. The government is considering the best way forward. We must respect the different viewpoints, consider them carefully, talk to the different groups, and if and when we decide to move, we will do so in a way that continues to balance between these different viewpoints and avoids causing a sudden destabilizing change in social norms and public expectations. If you look at successive court judgments over the years, the courts have consistently taken the position that these are highly contentious social issues and within the province of Parliament. The heterosexual stable family remains a stable norm, and the current legal position reflects our society's norms, values, and attitudes. That's what the courts have said. In this latest judgment, the court noted the compromise which Singapore has struck in respect of Section 377A is unique. Our approach strikes a balance between preserving the legislative status quo whilst accommodating the concerns of those directly affected by the legislation. The court recognized that the government did this in order to avoid driving a deeper wedge within our society. It also noted that Singapore's approach seeks to keep what to do with Section 377A within the democratic space. Socially charged issues such as Section 377A call for continued discussion and open-ended resolution within the political domain where we can forge consensus rather than in win-lose outcomes in court. In this way, we can accommodate divergent interests, avoid polarization, facilitate incremental change. Furthermore, the court highlighted the importance of creating space for peaceful coexistence amongst the various groups, especially since the balance between the various interests around Section 377A has grown more delicate. These opinions align with the approach that the government has taken in dealing with Section 377A and that it intends to take as it considers the changes in our social landscape since 2007. I'll now move on to the rest of my COS speech. I'll focus on two issues, the death penalty and our approach to rehabilitation. My colleagues from MHA will talk about MHA's plans, new capabilities, use of technology, tackling drug abuse, and the fight against scams. Mr. Speaker, sir, with Madam Deputy Speaker, Madam Chairman, with your permission, may I distribute the annexes to the members of the House? Members also can access these material through the SGPAL MP mobile app.
Go ahead.
Now, criminal justice systems have various objectives. I've spoken before about this. I will mention four today. To deter crimes. Second, to provide proportionate punishment for offenders. Three, to protect public safety. And four, to rehabilitate ex-offenders. How our government balances these objectives depends on a country's needs and values. In that context, I want to talk about death penalty, which I'll call DP for short. Annex A sets out the list of offences for which the DP can be imposed. Mr. Murali Pillai asked if the death penalty remains relevant. I'll answer by making the following points. First, does the DP have deterrent effect? Second, what is its effect on the behaviour of drug traffickers? Third, Singaporeans' attitude towards the DP. Fourth, specifically, what are the wider harms imposed on society by drug traffickers? And fifth, the outcomes in Singapore as a result of the approach we have taken. First, the deterrent effect of DP. In our view, it has had a clear, strong impact, deterrent impact, based on past behavior as well as current trends. With your permission, Madam Deputy Speaker, may I display slides on the screen, please?
Let's go ahead.
Let me deal with the past first. In 1961, DP for kidnapping was introduced. 3 years before, the average was 29 cases per year. 3 years after, the average became one case per year. It has remained very low since. Slide two, please. Firearms robbery. It was on the rise in the 1970s. In 1973, 174 cases. Government introduced DP in November 1973. Number of firearms offences immediately fell by 39% in 1974 to 106 cases and continued to decline in subsequent years, ever lower. Firearms offences remain very rare today in Singapore. So that's the historical perspective, and the charts speak for themselves. Now let me talk about the current situation. I could go on a little bit about it, but let me just deal with a few short points. It appears to us, specifically to drugs, by reference to drugs, that our position on drugs, including imposing the DP, is well known in some of our neighboring regions. And that has contributed to a strong deterrent effect. MHA specifically commissioned a study on persons from parts of the region outside Singapore. These are places from where most of our arrested drug traffickers have come from in recent years. We wanted to get a sense of what people in these places knew and thought. And this is what we found. 82% of respondents believed that DP makes people not to want to commit serious crimes in Singapore. These are not Singaporeans. These are people in the region. 69% believed that the DP is more effective in discouraging people from committing serious crimes compared to life imprisonment. 69%. There are many around the world, some in Singapore, who say, well, you know, why don't you replace it with life imprisonment? 69% in the region believe that the DP is more effective in discouraging people from committing serious crimes compared to life imprisonment. 83% believed that the DP makes people not to want to traffic substantial amount of drugs into Singapore. 83%. I emphasize this. These are the places from which many of our traffickers come from. You remove the death penalty, that number, 83%, will surely be reduced because there is money to be made. Just go back to the second question. 69% believed that DP is more effective than life imprisonment. It's a fair assumption to say that more people will traffic drugs into Singapore, more drugs will enter into Singapore, there will be more drug abusers in Singapore, and more Singaporean families and individuals will be harmed if we remove the death penalty, in particular the mandatory death penalty. It's a stark choice for Singaporeans. So those who campaign against the death penalty ought to answer these questions. These are debates we can have in society, but they ought to answer these questions and deal with them and face up to them squarely and then debate on that basis. Public policy requires making choices. My view is that Singaporean lives and livelihoods, a large number of that, will be at risk. That is why we have taken a tough line on this. Second, the introduction of the DP has also changed the behavior of drug traffickers. In 1990, government introduced a mandatory death penalty for trafficking for more than 1.2 kilograms of opium. Comparing the 4 years before and after, there was a 66% reduction in the average net weight trafficked. In a 2018 study conducted by MHA, we found a very high level of awareness of the death penalty amongst convicted drug traffickers. This had influenced their drug trafficking behavior. And it is consistent with the survey I spoke about earlier in the region. One of the traffickers in this study said the following. He knew very clearly that if he were caught for trafficking a small amount, he would just go to jail for trafficking. But if he were caught with a larger amount, he would be at risk of the death penalty. And so he trafficked below the threshold amount. Mr. Murali Pillai also asked if Singaporeans continue to support the use of the death penalty. That's my third point. Majority of Singapore residents support the use of the death penalty and agree that the DP deters serious crimes. 2019, our MHA survey showed very strong support for the DP. We conducted a follow-up survey in 2021 with a segment specifically on mandatory death penalty. The results are still being analyzed, so my statements on that are preliminary. On the question as to whether the MDP is appropriate, 81% said it was appropriate for intentional murder. 71% said it was appropriate for firearm offenses. 66% said that it was appropriate for drug trafficking. And more than 80% also believed that the DP had deterred the commission of these offenses in Singapore. But it's not just a question of survey results, you know, whether more people agree or less people agree. If as policymakers, having studied the issues and the facts, we believe this is the right thing to do, then it's our duty, both mine and members, if you are convinced, to try and persuade people on what is the right course of action. In the end, we also have to lead by persuading, explaining, and if we are wrong, then the counter-arguments prevail. I'll now move to my fourth point on the wider harm of drugs and why we take a firm stance. Mr. Vikram Nair and Mr. Raj Joshua Thomas asked, how Singapore compared with countries that did not have DP for drug offences? Well, let me answer it in a broader way. Let's take a look at other cities around the world, some of which have taken a softer stance on drugs, and some are going or have already gone down the path of legalization. See the examples from the US and UK in Annex B1 and Annex B2. A CDC report estimates that more than 100,000 drug overdose deaths in the US took place in the one-year period ending April 2021. In Delaware, one of the places most affected by drug abuse in the U.S., more than 2,300 people have died of drug overdoses since 2016. That's about the number of people who have also died of COVID-19 in Delaware since the beginning of the pandemic until end of 2021. In Baltimore, spending on drugs is estimated at an incredible US $163 million, with over 19,000 heroin users. That's just heroin. People are caught in brutal, vicious cycles. Criminal records and poor job prospects push them into the drug trade, and violence is part and parcel of their lives. Either they use violence or it is used on them. And the impact of drugs on innocent children, babies, is rarely ever discussed. With your permission, Madam Deputy Speaker, may I display a video on the screen? I think it's useful for members to watch this video.
Please go ahead.
The number of babies born in withdrawal dependency inherited from a mother battling addiction has risen fivefold over the last dozen years. In 2013 alone, more than 27,000 babies were born addicted to opioids like heroin or prescription painkillers. But what happens after these babies endure the excruciating withdrawal process? Warning, some of the video we're about to show you is disturbing. The story from our senior legal and investigative correspondent, Cynthia McFadden.
They are the most innocent victims of our country's opiate epidemic. It's hard to watch, but for too long, we have looked away.
And in many countries, including in Singapore, there is a small group who will bring out sob stories on the drug traffickers and their parents and how they should not face the penalties that the law provides. Their parents will be put on display crying. What about these babies? What about the innocent children? Who speaks for them? Huge numbers of babies born in withdrawal and addiction. And these drug traffickers profit from destroying these children and their families. Where should our sympathies be placed? Based on the 2017 data, nearly 80 newborns are diagnosed with neonatal abstinence syndrome every day. This is a snapshot, what you saw, of what it looks like. We have largely not had this in Singapore. It's news to us. So those who ask us to abolish the death penalty should answer these questions. Madam, may I seek your permission to play a second video now?
Yes. Yes,
this is a situation in San Francisco.
The number of babies.
This is the Tenderloin, and what they live here is what residents call the tender life. Well, it's not very tender. It's anything but tender. It's sleeping on the streets. It's hard drug use. It's mental illness. And you put it all together, and you add in something in the last couple of years called fentanyl, and you've taken what was in sad mix and made it absolutely toxic and dangerous.
How does it work? I think for a lot of people, it's shocking. You have open drug dealing. You have clearly kind of street gangs positioned at every corner. You have people shooting up in the middle of the street. How can this happen in a major American city?
It's an unintended consequence of a lot of things. First of all, we decriminalized the drugs. We made it so that possession of them was no longer a felony. So we thought that that was going to take people easier off the streets. Instead, when it opened up the floodgates for open use, mental illness, we don't have places to put them mentally ill. And even if we did, there's a political debate about whether you're going to be violating their civil rights if you do put them in an institution. You put all that together, and this is what gets built. It wasn't intended, it wasn't sold to the voters this way, but that's what happened.
If it gets to that situation, it'll be too late. There are some who will say, we are not talking about decriminalization in Singapore. They will say our laws are already adequate. We are talking only about removing the death penalty or mandatory death penalty. Keep all the other tough laws. My response is this. First of all, I gave you the survey results. Removing the DP and what impact it will have psychologically. Second, we have never said that the DP or MDP alone is sufficient. It is, however, a key part of our system and approach to deal with drug trafficking. You need many different things to keep Singapore relatively free of drugs. Good intelligence, strong enforcement, stiff punishments, rehabilitation for offenders, and deterrence. And you heard earlier what people in the region say, what convicted drug traffickers say about the DP being a very strong deterrent. So I'm telling members, we have to think carefully about this. Before removing any part of this framework or going soft, and those who advise for removal often compare us with countries that have already lost the drug war. And I'm not sure if they understand the consequences or choose not to understand them. Because the consequences are plain for everyone to see. It's not rocket science. Madam Deputy Speaker, with your permission, can I have another video played on the situation in San Francisco from a former abuser?
Yes.
This is the Tenderloin.
In your experience, living on the streets, being on the streets, working with people on the streets, the folks who are unsheltered, homeless in San Francisco, what percentage do you think have serious drug addiction?
This is, again, just empirical evidence based on me being homeless, 85%.
85%. What does that lifestyle look like? I mean, you have people that have an addiction. They're feeding that addiction with kind of petty crime or a hustle. And describe how that economy works.
It's an exhausting lifestyle. And it's exhausting because you're hustling all the time. And you're always, whatever you do, you're primary goal is to maintain your drug addiction, right? So you have people that go out and boost and steal, shoplift. You have people that haul drugs for the dealers. You have people that break into cars. You have a lot of criminal activity that goes around to help supplement whatever services they're already receiving.
At the end of our interview, Tom showed me the spot he would sleep on a piece of cardboard and smoke fentanyl. After a half dozen arrests and the threat of a long prison term, Tom finally accepted an offer to go into rehab. He says the police saved his life. If they hadn't created some accountability, he would be dead or in prison.
In the 1990s, CNB arrested about 6,000 abusers per year. Now it arrests about 3,000 to 3,500 per year. It hasn't become less effective. It's just that we have managed to reduce the number of people who engage in drug abuse. It's a large number of people, potential abusers, whose lives have been saved. And it's not just them. You consider their families. So many more have been saved. And crime has been kept low in Singapore because the drug abuse situation has been kept low. Singapore does well in measures on safe cities, such as the Gallup survey and the Safe Cities Index. But if we change the laws, we cannot expect crime to remain low. The drug problem has also contributed to the homelessness situation in many major U.S. cities. The tents that were in Skid Row in L.A. now covers many blocks. And this is what it looks like. Madam Deputy Speaker, can I have your permission? Mr. Speaker, sir, Chairman, can I have your permission to
please do
play video 3, please?
When you walk around here, it really feels like you're on a different planet.
Hygiene is a really big problem here in Skid Row. They don't have to only worry about COVID. They also have to worry about tuberculosis outbreaks, hepatitis, or typhus. Some of those places are rats infested. And look at the people. They just sit down on the street right here. Some of them just put a mattress down and sleep in the middle of the way.
I'm not seeking to draw a direct comparison. There are many other reasons for homelessness in these places. But just note, the homeless also have addiction and drug abuse problems, and some of that will spill over when people can't live with others because of drug abuse problem. They will spill out onto the streets, and crime will go up. And if you look at UK, we see similar problems. In Sheffield, for example, the drug problem has led to an increase in violent and armed crime. Innocent children get killed. Number of people dying of drug-related deaths in Sheffield has tripled between 2010 and 2020. Now let me turn to outcomes in Singapore. Mr. Murali Pillai asked whether there was a worsening of the drug situation. My answer is the number of drug abusers in Singapore remains low, though there are some worrying trends. The number of new drug abusers is higher than we would like it to be. I had earlier shared how the number of abusers arrested in Singapore has, over the years, gone down and how that is also linked to low crime. Drugs are not the sole cause of murders, violence, or crime. And when we look at the overseas examples, a variety of other factors shape safety in cities, including the availability of guns, how effective the criminal justice system and the police are, and many other factors. But in my view, drug abuse and the prevalence of drug gangs is an important contributing factor, and it links up to quite a lot of other factors. So by being tough on drug offenses, we minimize the harm of drugs in our society. If we removed the DP, I have no doubt more drug syndicates and traffickers will bring larger amounts of drugs into Singapore, and Singaporeans and their families will suffer. We prefer not to have to impose a death penalty on anyone, but we have to continue to do what is best for us as a matter of policy. Mr. Murali also asked whether we would consider allowing issuance of Certificates of Substantive Assistance, or CSA, to offenders when the case is before the Court of Appeal instead of before their trial. The purpose of the CSA is to encourage offenders to come clean and provide assistance before trial. Provide assistance to CNB in breaking down criminal gangs, drug gangs. The purpose will be undermined if we allow offenders to fight a case, put up a defense based on other legal arguments, and then offer the information later and ask for CSA. So we do not intend to make that move. So that's what I have to say on the DP. Given the time available, I have not said everything I would have liked to have said. Let me now move on to the second part of my speech, which is rehabilitation. There is a tendency to think of the Singapore system as being tough. I don't blame members because I've just spent, I think, the last 20 minutes or so explaining why we need to be tough on drug offenders. But it's not, to describe it simply as tough is not a complete and accurate descriptor. We have to be tough on drugs, but the complete picture, even on drugs, is not about just being tough. We are tough on those that we need to be tough on. That's the drug traffickers. But, for example, drug abusers, we try to not even treat them as criminals. We instead treat their drug dependency through a variety of means. And without a criminal record, if their situation is that they're only drug abusers and haven't committed any other crime. And our criminal justice system has evolved quite substantially to help those who have gotten onto the wrong side. And one key aspect of that is rehab. So let me talk about the different aspects of it. As part of rehab, we have moved to alternate types of sentencing. And Annex C lists some of the types of orders which our courts can make for minor offences. The courts can consider these in appropriate cases instead of traditional sentences such as imprisonment or fine. And they are the mandatory treatment order, MTO, day reporting order, community work order, community service order, short detention order. Now, a second aspect is rehab within prison. Mr. Murali Pillai and Mr. Joshua Thomas asked about our efforts to improve the employability of inmates and their work with our work with the community in bringing down recidivism rates. Our two-year recidivism rate is the lowest it has been, 20% for the most recent release cohort. And it is one of the lowest for comparable cities around the world. But there is more to be done. The five-year recidivism rate for the 2016 release cohort is higher at 41%. It has gone down a little bit over the years, but we want to try and bring it down further. And there are some factors that can lead to a successful reintegration in the long term. These include stable employment, positive pro-social networks, personal motivation to seek help and contribute to society. When inmates are admitted to prison, they have their risks and needs identified and undergo appropriate programs to address them. There are four broad areas. One, psychology-based correctional programs. Two, family programs. Three, skills training and employment assistance. And four, community corrections. Under psychology-based correctional programs, correctional rehab specialists and psychologists do intervention programs for inmates. Inmates may have rehab needs, including, you know, relating to substance abuse, antisocial attitudes, interpersonal violence, sexual violence, other mental health needs. So how experts will look at these issues. The second aspect is working with the family. Strong family support is essential in the rehab and reintegration journey. Prisons conduct programs, social skills training program and family reintegration program, they call it FRP. The aim is to help the inmates link up, bond with their family, strengthen the bonds, family, loved ones. Prisons also works with community partners. Center for Fathering, Salvation Army, New Life Stories, to facilitate family bonding programs for inmates and their children. Some families may also face difficulties during the inmates' incarceration. Prisons proactively refers families of inmates who require assistance to family service centers. In the broader community, grassroots volunteers are roped in to support families impacted by incarceration. Today, there are over 1,200 grassroots volunteers under the Yellow Ribbon Community Project, involving all 93 divisions across Singapore. And third is the skills training and employment assistance. This is a key focus. Having a stable job upon release reduces the risk of re-offending. Mr. Mark Che asked about the success of the Train and Place and Grow initiative. The Tap and Grow initiative works on equipping inmates with skills to secure and sustain jobs. And he also asked if there are plans to expand this initiative. The prison school, you know, deals with inmates. They can go for academic programs while in prison. Programs range from GCE to diploma and degree programs. And last year, Prisons and Yellow Ribbon Singapore, YRSG, worked with ITE to introduce the NITEC in Services, Business Services Program. First batch of 29 graduated in February this year. Under the Tap and Grow initiative, training academies in prison have been set up. They are in partnership with the media, the precision engineering sector, and the logistics sectors. Inmates will be offered jobs by the partner employers upon release. 28 inmates completed their training and graduated with diplomas in media courses. Some of them have since been released and they are working in media-related jobs. Others are waiting for job interviews. There were 30 inmates from the first batch of training programs for precision engineering and logistics, and about 650 inmates will benefit from Tap and Grow initiative in these three sectors every year. This year, YRSG does aim to, make the initiative bigger and go into the food and services sector or food services sector. YRSG has developed also a digital literacy master plan for inmates to gain basic digital skills in prison so that they are better prepared for the job market upon release. An estimated 750 inmates will be trained in basic digital skills each year. YRSG has also partnered IMDA to roll out digital skills training for older residents at the Selarang Halfway House. And this training helps with digital services, including government services and financial services. A fourth aspect I want to mention, community corrections. Research has shown that there are better rehab outcomes when rehab in prison is complemented by community-based programs. And prisons has been expanding community corrections. As at end of 2021, there were about 3,400 supervisees undergoing rehab in the community, double the number from 5 years ago. Results from the community corrections continue to be encouraging. In 2021, close to 90% of the inmates who were placed on community-based programs completed them successfully. Inmates who have completed these programs have a lower risk of reoffending. Prisons is also developing a digitalized learning and support package for inmates. The aim is to better prepare inmates for their emplacement in the community. The efforts I've described will not be effective if the community is not willing to give offenders a second chance. YRSG helps with our reintegration efforts, and my colleague, Professor Faisal will speak about this later. Mr. Leon Pereira, I think, reprised a part of the FICA debate. At that time I pointed out to him that in Singapore we take investigations very seriously, and I explained how the system works, and the Prime Minister can be the subject of independent investigations. He didn't respond then, but he's come back to it today. Now, what is our structure? If there is wrongdoing by anyone, whether a minister or civil servant or private sector person, there will be investigations. Very few people doubt that. And we over the years, we added on the checks. This government has added on checks on itself, which are very rare elsewhere. We institutionalized it such that the CPIB can go straight to the Prime Minister, but where the Prime Minister himself is the possible subject of investigations, or if the Prime Minister doesn't want to do something, the CPIB can go to the President. Not many countries have done this, as I said, and I'll come back to this point. And therefore, if there is any wrongdoing or suspected wrongdoing known to anyone, including a suspicion of foreign interference or influence, can let CPIB know. CPIB has the resources to carry out the investigations, and it has the ability to tap on to other agencies for the appropriate additional help or work that needs to be done. And FICA put in place a framework where interactions will cross the line and you become the subject of foreign influence. So there's a legal basis to act. Mr. Pereira's suggestion, if I understood him correctly, is that why not we set up a separate ombudsman with the resources to carry out all these investigations? Because he had a question about whether the CPIB was adequately resourced, trained, does it have the ability to handle these matters? So my inference from that way of phrasing the question is, therefore the agency, whichever agency is set up, must replicate, I suppose, many parts of our law enforcement agencies, including our intel agencies, so that they can do this on a standalone basis. But if that is a suggestion, if I had understood him correctly, I would suggest it doesn't make much sense. Because, you know, how do you replicate, at what cost, an entire investigative mechanism outside the government? And let me make 3 points. If you only have the ombudsman without this apparatus that I described, then he or she will go to the law enforcement agencies. Now, here, in such a situation, the law enforcement agencies can go to the President. That's a check. There's an independent person who can give the directions and who can authorize. Second, Mr. Pereira referred to New Zealand, and I have often found that, you know, we make these references. They sound sexy, but then when you actually look at what's happening, I find that the debates get very academic without any grounding in reality, without perhaps either understanding or acknowledging what really happens in Singapore. What is our situation? How well we have managed to handle and keep corruption low and official wrongdoing low, and how other countries are in this context. Let me just read something from The Guardian, which is, I think, in January 2020, about New Zealand and foreign influence. New Zealand's international reputation for political integrity has taken a battering recently. The country's Minister for Justice, Andrew Little, admitted last month, like many democracies around the world, ours is vulnerable to those abroad who would seek to interfere in our democratic processes and influence the outcome. I'm not going to read the whole article. I'll make it available to members. I'll give the reference in a while. A Financial Times article this month said that New Zealand was, quote, on the edge of viability as a member, close quotes, of its allied relationships because of its, quote, supine attitude towards China and, quote, compromised political system, close quotes. New Zealand's National Party MP Todd McClay was featured in a report by Freedom House as an example of how, they say, which foreign government forges relationships with foreign politicians who promote a certain view in local media. McClay is infamous for receiving New Zealand dollars $150,000 from a China-based businessman, Lang Lin. New Zealand allows donations via New Zealand-registered companies, even if they are foreign-owned. The country's new legislation on electoral funding did not include changes to this massive loophole. In 2016, New Zealand was described as, quote, at the heart, close quotes, of global money laundering. The ease for foreigners to set up a company in the country is one of the reasons why money launderers have been attracted to do business there. You would think New Zealand's other political parties would be making hay with all this material, but they have been mute. Now, I would ask members to perhaps do their research before they cite various countries and their institutions as models. Second, here we have an elected government which has to govern, and I'll come back to this point and explain it a bit later. Third, let me ask, you set up an ombudsman, you know, with or without the full suite of resources and without any oversight from government. Who then deals with misconduct by the ombudsman or the officers within that office? Mr. Pereira said during the FICA debate, quis custodiet ipsos custodes, if I recall correctly. For some reason, I think that phrase seems to have lost favor now. Who guards the guards? Now, take a hypothetical situation. Say you have an organization where the top leaders engage in wrongdoing. Or, for example, say they set up a disciplinary committee to cover up what they did rather than actually investigate. I think you can ask, quis custodiet ipsos custodes. And if Mr. Pereira, I suppose, if he was part of any such organization, would be the first one to make such a point. But for the government, with the systems in place and the variety of people who can lodge complaints and investigate, AGO, Attorney General, you have CPIB, the police, civil servants are obliged, if they think their minister is doing wrong, to take it up to higher authority. And if they believe that the higher authority is not acting properly, they can take it up all the way. And their civil servants are protected through the structure of Public Service Commission, which in turn is protected through the fact that appointment cannot be interfered with willy-nilly by the government. So if you take the senior appointments, including the chief of CPIB, Chief Justice, Attorney General, all these, there are carefully constructed structures on these appointments. And so I would say look at all that first and look at the ground situation before we start talking about replicating more and more institutions outside. In contrast, look at countries with a longer runway in democracy. Australia, I stand corrected, but in the short time I had since Mr. Pereira spoke, the example I found is Independent Commission Against Corruption, ICAC, a state-level agency that reports to the Premier, in this case, the case that was highlighted to me, Prime Minister of New South Wales. If you look at what's the situation in the UK, I'm reading from something that Institute for Government and Ministerial Code. What does the code say? All of the courts, meaning the courts for Wales, Scotland, and UK, give the final authority for decisions about action to be taken to the Prime Minister or First Minister. Or in Northern Ireland, the relevant nominating officer of a particular minister's party. So it's a Prime Minister. Now, they do, since 2006, UK government ministerial code breaches have been investigated through an independent advisor on ministerial interests or by the Cabinet Secretary. But there is no requirement to follow any particular process. That's the UK situation. And I think the member will be well aware of the situation in the UK more recently and for some period in the recent past. Here a second question on caning and whether there was a requirement for those who have been caned to thank the officers after the caning. There is no such requirement. And he suggested there should be an outside commission to decide on institutional caning. And over the years, I've listened to the speeches, Mr. Pereira in particular, there seems to be a typical solution that is suggested for many different aspects of government, set up an independent mechanism outside. I mean, reading from his speech in November 2020, 4th of November, an ombudsman would function as an independent office to investigate complaints about administrative decisions or actions of a public agency, including delay, rudeness, negligence, arbitrariness, inconsistency, oppressive behavior, unlawfulness. Every aspect of government, anyone who is unhappy, go to an ombudsman. You've got to then set up an entire huge structure at the taxpayer's expense to investigate this. Rather than having a proper legal process, including a complaint system, independent investigation set up, say, by the police with some outside people sitting on it, or judicial review. And in FICA, there was a suggestion of ombudsman, prisons, another agency. I mean, essentially, we can subcontract many aspects of government if we go down this route. And you won't solve the problems because who guards the guards? So I would suggest we start with what is working well, what is not working, and for what is not working, how do we better do things? I think these are things on which there can be positive contributions. And my ministry will always be open to positive contributions, regardless of who it comes from, whether people in this chamber, whether from the government or opposition, or members of public. If the suggestion is good and valid, we will study it, and if it's possible to be implemented, we will implement it. Thank you, sir.